this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really interesting guests. We're going to talk to Shelley London on the Family Dinner Project in the first half. And in the second half, we're going to talk to Norbert Huser, and he's going to talk about 5G technology. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
Suicide continues to become more common in the United States, with rural areas hit hardest by this ongoing crisis of despair, a new study reports. Deprivation, isolation, and lack of access to mental health care all appear to be driving the crisis in rural America, said lead researcher Danielle Steele-Smith. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center in Columbus. Suicide rates increased 41% between 1999 and 2016, from a median of 15 per 100,000 people to more than 21 per 100,000, county-by-county data show. Median means half had higher rates, half were lower. Rural folks tend to be at higher risk than city dwellers, the researchers found. Suicide risks were 22 per 100,000 in rural counties between 2014 and 2016, compared with about 18 per 100,000 in large metropolitan counties, the nationwide data revealed. The new study was published online September 6th in JAMA Network Open. For the first time, scientists have found four spots on your DNA that might determine whether you wield your pen with your left hand. Of the four gene regions, three are associated with proteins involved in brain development and structure, according to a genetic analysis of about 400,000 people in the United Kingdom, including more than 38,000 left-handers. The study also found that in left-handed participants, the language areas of the left and right sides of the brain communicate with each other in a more coordinated way, said Dr. Akira Weiberg, a University of Oxford medical research fellow who did the analysis. This raises the intriguing possibility for future research that left-handers might have an advantage when it comes to performing verbal tasks, he said in a news release. The findings were published September 4th in the journal Brain. Vegetarianism is all the rage these days, but a new study suggests that slicing meat from your diet might raise your risk of stroke slightly. While vegetarians had a 22% lower risk for heart disease, they had a 20% higher risk for stroke, British researchers found. Meanwhile, people who ate fish but no other meats had a 13% lower risk of heart disease with no increased stroke risk. Lead researcher Tammy Tong, a nutritional epidemiologist in the Nuffield Department of Population Health at the University of Oxford, said the lower risk of heart disease is likely at least partly due to lower weight, lower blood pressure, lower blood cholesterol, and lower rates of diabetes linked to pescatarian or vegetarian diets. The report was published September 4th in the BMJ Journal. People with peripheral artery disease have a much lower risk of death if they take cholesterol-lowering statins as directed by their doctor, a new study reports. About 200 million people worldwide suffer from PAD, a condition in which arteries feeding blood to the legs become clogged, researchers explained. However, patients who took their prescribed statins had a 20% rate of death over more than 4 years of follow-up, compared with about 34% for people who either stopped taking statins or never started them, European researchers found. Previous studies have underscored the health benefits of statins in patients with PAD, but this new report shows that those benefits can lead to a longer life, said Dr. Robert Rosenson, who was not involved in the study. The researchers presented their findings recently at the European Society of Cardiology's annual meeting in Paris.
We have Shelley London with us today, and she is a contributor to the Family Dinner Project and the book that goes with it. So welcome, Shelley.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you on today. So this Family Dinner Project, can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be?
Well, sure, I'd be delighted to. I had a corporate career for many years, and then I was lucky enough to spend a year at Harvard as a fellow in what was then a brand new program called the Advanced Leadership Initiative. Designed for leaders who wanted to go from their primary career to more of a life of service. And as part of that program, one of the things that we did was we all needed to come up with some work that would be part of our future life, our reasons, our purpose in life going forward. And so the Family Dinner Project was one of the things that I came up with and created and at the time, and then was lucky enough to find a number of people who wanted to co-found it with me, and away we were, and that was 10 years ago, and today, all these years later, we have more than a million people we've worked with and helped thousands of people on in person as well.
And how do you help these people in person? What do they come as a family to you, or just as a single person?
Yeah, it's a great question. people come as a family, they come as schools, they come as parents and grandparents, and part of the thing is that we meet parents and families wherever they are, and while we certainly have some expertise, what this is really about is helping families find their own expertise and helping them find the benefits of family dinners. There are more than 20 years of research around the benefits of family dinners. There's physical benefits, which obviously, and psychological and social and even academic benefits of family dinner that are really amazing. And so, but in today's life, it's so hard to think about family meals because everybody is just so busy. So what we work with families and we learn from them and their wisdom. And the message that I think the one big message that we give families today that seems to be helpful for them is forget perfect. No matter who you are and how you think about family dinner, what gets in the way of it for so many people is they think it needs to be perfect, the perfect gourmet food or the perfect manners at the table or you name it. And we help them say just good enough so we can they can start to get the benefits of family dinner. And we've learned many tricks and tips over the years from families, and we share those with other families.
And what are some of those tips that you've come across?
Well, there are lots of them. Name an obstacle, and I can give you a tip.
But even having teenagers that might not want to talk at meals or that just want to get it done and run off to their next project.
Well, that is a great one. And in fact, there have been studies with teenagers that they say they don't want to, but they really do. But part of why they might feel like they just want to run away is that sometimes there's tension at the table. Maybe dinner table has become a place where kids get grilled. What were your grades like? How did you do on this? And it becomes a pressured environment. So the idea is to make it fun. And in fact, our theme of the Family Dinner Project is food, fun, and conversation about things that matter. So rather than make the dinner table a place where kids get a litany of questions, instead, how can it be fun for them? How can they join in making of the food? How can they be part of making the food selections? How can a teenager bring some music, some of their favorite music to the table? How can the family play games at the table together where everybody has a lot of laughs? How to start conversations that will lead to laughter and joy rather than a feeling of tension? And there's lots of these kinds of ideas we have that instead of the family dinner being a place for teenagers to feel like they want to run away from, dinner becomes more of an oasis where they feel welcome, respected, heard, and then lo and behold, they want more of it. And families have told us that not only do their own teenagers want it, not every day, I'm not saying it's some perfect idyllic world, but their friends want to come too.
Wow. So just keeping anything that's not fun out of the conversation for a full hour or 40 minutes or whatever you can get.
Yeah, well, and make it fun, yeah, but it can also be meaningful. There are a lot of things that can be talked about in terms of the world events. We have on the Family Dinner Project website, we have a lot of conversation starters, and we have a thing called Conversation of the Week, where we take news events about serious issues and turn it into conversation starters so families can have conversations about meaningful things that are important to the family, but to do it in a way that doesn't feel punitive or harsh, but feels engaging. And so it doesn't have to be a laugh every minute, but it's engaging. And the idea of engaging everyone with respect so everyone's heard, that's where these very well-researched benefits come from, is engaged families and engaged conversation.
And that's allowing everyone at the table equality and time to speak and time to share.
Exactly, exactly. But there are lots of obstacles that get in the way. You know, there's time, there's technology, and any of those that you want to talk about, I'm happy to do, because we've had many families who've helped us think about how do you deal with these things.
How do you create space without the technology to really have face-to-face discussions and have that time for real personal conversation?
Yeah, it's a great question, and different families do different things. Sometimes the worst offenders are the parents who can't put their phones down because they're afraid that something from work is going to come up or whatever. So lots of families have tried different things. Some families take a basket, and they all throw their phones in it for 20 minutes, and that works for some families. For some families, it's the idea that the most you get is one look at the phone. Some families do that. Some families say, okay, this one night, nothing. Other families say, let's use our phones to help create conversation ideas. So come to the table with a video that you want to show everybody. So there you're using technology to actually encourage conversation. You show a funny video and everybody starts to talk about it. So those are just a few ways of either eliminating or using technology to get people to really talk.
That's brilliant. Yes, that's great, Shelley. So what is some of the research around self-esteem and depression and that in teenagers, in high school years, as far as being belonging and coming to the table and or not belonging?
Yeah, well, we have on our team, one of our co-founders is a family therapist and is super aware of all the research and would be better able to quote specific research than I am. But what I would say is that what we've learned from the research is that family dinners, where the environment is this supportive environment where people feel respected and heard, the research is really stunning in terms of being a preventative, let's call it intervention, against things such as eating disorders and depression and being helpful towards self-esteem. If you get kids to talk at an early age at the dinner table, in fact, dinner conversation is better for building vocabulary than reading aloud. Now, reading aloud is great, but dinner conversation is even better. So this idea of bringing kids to the table, starting when they're young, getting them talking, they start to feel this respect, they're being heard, and that whole engagement starts to lead to a prevention, if you will, of many of these kinds of issues that affect kids as they get into those, particularly the kind of dangerous middle school, high school years where self-esteem can really plummet.
Hmm. And Shelley, do you come alongside and come to the tables of the families that you're encouraging and showing how to do this?
Well, not so much in their homes, but what we do, we have different ways of working with families and different kinds of groups. And what we do is we simulate dinner. So we have something we call a community dinner. So let's say you have an organization that regularly meets, and we have a community dinner. And at that community dinner, we really have a model of what can happen at family dinners, how families can cook together, how they can have conversations together. We give them conversation starters and games they can play. And then at these community dinners, we have the kids go off and make dessert and play some games. Meanwhile, the adults, whether it's parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, whoever the caregivers are, they're having a parent workshop where they're talking about what gets in the way, what are the toughest things they experience, and then everybody brainstorms and we share ideas to overcome those obstacles. So the combination of experiencing this kind of family dinner and then talking about it, families can leave with, you know, what's one thing you want to try differently, or families can do things. We have a four-week program that families can follow, and we have a goal-setting tool on our website that lets families figure out what they want to try differently, and and, you know, try one thing at a time. But so how we work with them is through these community dinners and these workshops.
Fascinating. We're going to have to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the Family Dinner Project.